You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Scientists agree the first big tipping point in climate change has already triggered in the Arctic. Extremely rapid warming, permafrost thaw, and disappearing sea ice have changed Earth's energy balance, and it speeds warming around the world. Radio EcoShock covered this in several recent programs. Most Arctic land and seacoast is found in Russia and then in Canada. In fact, about 40% of Canada is above the 60th parallel. Only about 120,000 people live there, the majority being Aboriginal people. Thawing land is shifting, coastlands change, long-standing ways of life are in trouble. To find out more, we go to a 40-year resident and radio broadcaster in the Yukon Territory from a village on a lake south of Whitehorse. Rob Hopkins broadcasts to the tiny community of Tagish and to the world by the Internet. From the Yukon, Rob Hopkins, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, nice to meet everybody out there. Hello, Alex.
So you're the other Rob Hopkins. I tend to think of the transition guy, but you're sort of Radio Rob in the Yukon, I gather.
Yeah, Radio Rob. I've been working in communication 30 years now. I live in a small community 120 kilometers southwest of Whitehorse.
I suppose most people living in Canada's north experience climate changes. What is most noticeable in the Yukon, would you say?
40 years ago, when I first came here, you would get minus 40 below Celsius for 3 weeks in November, and then cold all through the winter. And then that changed, the 25 years ago, that you'd end up with no 40 below before December, and you'd get 40 below stretch in January. And there's been in recent years, it hasn't even gone to 30 below a couple of years here, which was really strange. And, you talk to First Nation elders and they tell it's all part of a pattern that this has happened in the past. But some of the stuff that I see right now that's happening and for environmental issues in here is a lot of Canadians think the North is all green and everybody's pumping money into this and results. But actually, I think there's more pollution being generated with the money that's coming from Ottawa here rather than trying to fix things or creating more problems for the environment.
Well, one part of that, I guess, is the mining. And you mentioned to me in an email that there certainly have been problems.
Right. Mining's a backbone of the Yukon industry. And if it's done properly, resource extraction, then it's not a problem. But time and time again, we see the same model happening in the north. Somebody comes in, wants to set up a mine. There's supposed to be security deposits and environmental compliance. And so these mines operate all loosey-goosey. The government looks the other way. And then when the mine has extracted all the money out of the territory, then the mine just says, well, we're bankrupt and we're going to leave. And the Yukon taxpayers is left holding the bag. But what's happened is the mine has actually taken the money out. The government people have got their cut. We're left holding these ugly resources. And some of these companies aren't even Canadian. We wine and dine Chinese companies to come here and invest. They come here, they take the money out, they leave an environmental mess.
Let's get to climate change again. Officially, the Yukon is already above the 2-degree warming danger mark, and even 4.3 degrees C warmer in the winter just since 1948. That's a huge change. So you're one of the world's hotspots and already past the UN goals set for the end of the century. Millions of people further south think if the weather gets too hot, that the rest of us will just move up to the Arctic. I don't think that would work out.
No, this is terrible. You're right. There's we know it up here. We get climate change, all kinds of things happening. But I take a look at what's happening down in southern Canada and down in the United States. Yes, it's going to be cooking down there. It already is cooking. It's way too hot. We're seeing that up here. And some of the stuff which is really difficult to describe to Canadians and people from outside the world, they see the Yukon is a big pristine wilderness and untouched beauty. And you drive on the highways here, all the trees are clear cut. There's huge carbon heat sinks being created. Whitehorse is, just look at it on a map, it's one big piece of asphalt now. And that's very, very bad for the environment to be able to go in and into nature and disrupt it like that. you know, some of the other effects that we're seeing, you know, is flooding here and on. Last year we had a major flood. This year the ground is already saturated. The same thing is going to happen. We're going to see major flooding here. Glaciers melting, definitely warming up. No question about that.
Well, scientists on the show have told us that the Arctic will just get wetter and wetter, and rains that used to fall on the southern croplands get pulled further north. And for wildlife and First Nations hunters, that just isn't good news.
Right. The predictions here, and I can say in the area that I live in, the Yukon, is milder winters and wetter, damper summertime.
Does the Yukon have oil and gas industries, Rob?
There's a little bit of that that has been going on. There's some controversy. The Yukon government has been pushing fracking. There was a huge public backlash to that. But the government and Yukon Energy Corp, the sole provider of energy in the Yukon, is all gung-ho to get into fracking. And they've all publicly said, oh, they're not doing this. But take a look at the infrastructure. What do? We spent $40 million on a LNG plant to power the Yukon. Another announcement that just came on the radio, we're setting up green charging stations. Everybody's going green, environmental, switch to electricity. Where's the electricity come from? All we're doing is just bringing more generator shacks in and setting them up beside the highway. So there is no long-term environmental plans for resource-friendly energy.
Well, does the government of the Yukon have a plan for cutting their emissions and sustainability?
No. Yukon government, there's some good people that work there. Most people just want their pensions and move on.
I wonder how Canadians will heat their homes without fossil fuels. It will take a lot of electric power, and we can double or triple that for the Yukon. Does the far north have more rivers that could provide hydro, or what about wind, lots of wind? What are your thoughts?
I work in communications, and part of the stuff is mountaintop sites and generating power, and that's always the enigma. That they've done wind studies in the Yukon, debacles on and on. They've built wind farms and research centers, and they've tore the last one down. They're putting another windmill back up, but there isn't a real plan on long-term energy generation here. Nothing besides just a bunch of meetings from the government. There isn't any real action.
The Canadian Broadcasting Network, the CBC, just ran a feature story about the remote First Nations community of Old Crow getting off diesel with solar, but of course, solar only works for a few months when there's lots of sunlight in the Arctic.
Right. I've been to Old Crow. Old Crow's a really neat place. One of the longest continuously inhabited settlements in North America, the Bluefish Caves. All isolated. If you can imagine having to fly in every single thing that you need in your house or your community. So building materials, fuel, ATV parts, every single thing comes in by air. So getting off of diesel there, anything you can do will save tremendously on that. But as you point out, some of the northern communities, Old Crow stays really, really dark. But how can you generate power when there's no sun? That's just not sustainable.
We've also heard about astronomical grocery prices in the north and just general living costs. And now we have this pandemic and there's supply chain issues and all of that. How are people doing?
The Yukon, we are lucky because we're connected to the highway system to southern Canada. There's some disruptions just generally with supply chain, but I really wonder about some of the other communities I've spent time in the far north, Cambridge Bay, Kugluktuk, Kalawit, Nunavut, all those remote communities, the price of groceries there is staggering. And what's really difficult with those places, talk about food supply issues, you have to order your groceries 1 year in advance, pay everything in advance, and then put it on a barge. And a year later, your groceries arrive on a barge. And if you don't do that, then you're at the whim of going to the local store, and then you're going to start paying $35 for a 4-liter jug of milk and $16 for a box of cereal. So, yes, food security issues, very, very difficult in those remote communities.
I'm Alex Smith, and from the Yukon in Canada's north, we are speaking with Radio Rob Hopkins, known for do-it-yourself radio and television broadcasting, among other things. So our listeners on the West Coast, we have quite a few stations, for example, in California and Oregon, and in Australia, they've suffered through massive wildfires and smoke in the recent years. What's the fire situation in the Yukon? And by the way, does the government have the resources to fight these wildfires?
Good question, Alex. Previous lifetime, I worked for the Forestry Department. I was a radio operator. That's where I got my Radio Rob handle, and worked on some huge fires that we had here. And the last couple of years has not been bad for fires. But my business, I supply emergency alerting equipment for the broadcast sector, and I have clients all over Canada. And one of my clients is the First Nation down in Williams Lake, the Chilcotin First Nation, and they had record fires 2 years in a row. And I was all part of that effort, setting up local radio stations so they could provide messaging to their citizens in off-grid communities. The amount of devastation that comes from those fires, no matter who's in charge or how much money you have in it, Mother Nature, you don't stand a chance. You don't stand a chance on that. And one of the things that I found really interesting that happened after those big fires in Williams Lake area was it burned all the mountains, burned all the trees and everything. And then the next year and years after that, now what's happening is when it rains, there's no ground to soak up any of the moisture. So now we're going to see big flooding happening and flash floods and stuff. So yeah, fire's a big issue here.
Well, with some of the fires in the boreal forests in the north, people used to say, well, it doesn't matter that much because they'll regrow and they'll recapture that carbon. Well, maybe they will a couple of decades later, but some of the places, if they get burned over within 5 years, it kind of kills off the seeds, sterilizes the soil, and they may not regrow. They may convert into scrub or something else. So it looks like the North now, from what I've heard in the latest science, is becoming a carbon source rather than a carbon sink, even though it's getting wetter.
Yeah, there's methane gas being released too. That's a big issue. That could be a huge trigger for some catastrophe and stuff. It'd be right up your alley on your show, Alec.
Well, I have covered methane. There's two different worries. One of them is that you could get a burp of methane coming up from under the seabed, say off East Siberia, and that's been tracked for some years. Hasn't happened. Maybe could happen. We don't know. But what we do know is happening is the permafrost. Wherever those little lakes form all across the thawing permafrost, they're called thermokarst, then you get methane coming up instead of carbon dioxide. And as we know, it's 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So that's where I think the first big methane challenge out of the Arctic is going to come. It's going to come from the permafrost.
Yeah, definitely. I want to just back up on something about Indigenous and power stuff. So here we go. With power generation, there is some interesting news, though, with the First Nation in Atlin, the Taku River Tlingit. They're one of the only First Nation governments in the world that actually own their own power production unit. And right now they have a 4-megawatt hydro dam, and there's plans to expand that to 10 megawatts and to hook that up into the Yukon grid. So there is some activity with hydro generation here.
You know, it's amazing what you're doing. Tell us about your own broadcasting in the north and the new documentary coming out about you.
Yeah, boy, where do I start on that?
Well, what are you doing with your radio station? Why don't you start with your radio station and we'll work out from that.
I've been a broadcaster in the Yukon Territory now 25 years. I do this out of my small community of Tagish. I have the first commercial FM radio station in the Yukon, 106.7 FM, and that is call sign CFET. And any of my software runs on different radio stations, including the radio station and Whitehorse. So I provide emergency alerting systems that tie in with the national Telmarac system. So if there's a flash flood or there's a fire, then my systems will receive that information and automatically cut it in and broadcast it to local communities. I'm the only manufacturer of this equipment in Canada that also supports Indigenous languages. So in remote communities, when an emergency alert comes out, it will say in the local dialect, you know, there's a flood or there's a fire, and then the English message after that.
That's just brilliant. You know, it is amazing that an individual can become a broadcaster, really. I mean, before I did Radio EcoShock on the airwaves, I did it as a 24-hour net station for 3 years on a computer running out of my living room using radio automation software that wasn't that expensive. So what sort of advice would you offer to listeners who want to spread their message?
How to get your message out? That's a good question. Where I saw all this stuff coming years ago was with social media and being bombarded with all this information. How do you know what's real? Right now, you know, you can go to Facebook and good luck, man. But what I do like about radio does have trust involved in it. If I listen to a radio show in the morning and I know the person that's saying it, I go, hey, at least I know who that person is. It's not just some robot somewhere. So there's some level of trust that makes radio relevant today. And, you know, I love old radio. I love old technology. I like squeezing the life out of old technology and making it still work. And radio is still used not just in North America, but all over the world.
Well, we've talked about some of the problems of the North, but there must be a lot of great things about living there or you wouldn't be there. What are some of the benefits of being a true North Canadian?
The North is a great place to live. Don't get me wrong. You know, the cities, I'm not going to say they're slums, but they're definitely not representative of the rural Yukon, the real Yukon. And, you know, it's just like any other big city. Yeah, like today was great. You know, I was doing some work at my office. I looked outside and there's a moose eating a bunch of branches. And then there's a fox looking at me in the other window. You know, we have lots of elbow room here, wide open spaces. This is a real luxury right now. I wouldn't want to be stuck in downtown Toronto or Vancouver, that's for sure.
Well, I went and built a home in what we call the North, but you'd just call it the far South. But anyway, it was cold enough. But one of the advantages there was lots of cheap land, lots of room, and no building inspectors. So you just built whatever you could, and they were glad to see if you could survive there. So I don't know if it's like that still in the North, but there's a lot of freedom and space that comes with it that if you go to a place like India where there's packed people everywhere you go, even if you're in the woods, there's several people around you collecting things. It's a different feel that Canadians have, I think.
For sure. And, you know, some of the things that happens here, especially you see this over time, you know, progress, change, always going to happen. You know, there's lots of people that come here, get away, want to see the wilderness. There's lots of people come here, they want to get away from whatever place they just left, Burnaby or Mississauga, and they want to leave all that stuff behind. And what happens is they miss whatever they left behind, and then they want to recreate the problem that they left in the Yukon. And so you get end up with a mess like Whitehorse with all these brought in failed models, and all of a sudden everybody says, hey, we got to do all this stuff, and then it's rules and regulations, and that affects us out in the rural Yukon. Now we have policies that are being made by people that don't even live in the Yukon. You can be a Yukon government employee, you don't even have to work, you don't even have to live in the Yukon, for crying out loud.
What are some of the international environment issues that catch your attention, Rob Hopkins?
Yeah, interesting. I travel around a lot. 30 years, you know, Yukon's my base, but I spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, been to China lots over 30 years, seeing amazing stuff that's happened over there. China, boy, they want to take over the planet. Absolutely. They're plotting and scheming right now, but their plan is not to take over a toxified planet. So they're actually doing quite well in electronic EV stuff, you know, protecting the environment. They still turn a blind eye to lots of other stuff, but it, like I say, they have a plan. When I was there, they have electric motorcycles, you know, electric cars everywhere. Half of the motorcycles are electric now, and you know, they're really good because they don't use any noise, but they're bad because you can't hear them. You get hit by them on the street. You know, the other thing which I thought amazing in all the electric stuff in China was people think you need to have charging stations and huge infrastructure and stuff. Yeah, to plug your electric motorcycle in, you just have one of those little chargers like you have right now. You just plug in the wall. It wasn't anything big. Thailand before 30 years ago, big messes everywhere, garbage all over the place. They changed their culture. They said, hey, we're gonna clean up this mess. We don't want to leave messes all over the place. When I was in Nan, a small town, they had garbage pickup twice a day at houses. And, every shop has recycling stuff. They had standardized containers for recycling. This is where you put your bottles. This is where you put your glass. So they're really, really smart on that. They've done this not because the government has forced them to. They've done it because they have to. And if you just make a huge mess like we do in North America, you'll have no room in your village for anything. You'll just have a pile of rubbish around your place. So they're very, very resourceful in how to manage waste and how to recycle stuff to the max. Like, you don't, the stuff that we throw out in the garbage here in North America, that feeds a family of four for months and stuff, just as an example on our waste here. Everything that we can do to help the environment is good, and setting a good example and making it attractive to recycle. But beating people over the head with a big stick and telling them they have to recycle, that's a bad way to get any policy.
Yes, when I was in India, children were selling peanuts by the side of the road, and they were doing it in the pages of exercise books that students had used. So they're recycling that paper because there's no way they're going to go out and get brand new paper to sell peanuts by the street.
So, for example, in the film that you see, Alex, I'm building a TV station from stuff that I found in the dump. That's the premise of the film. And recycled radio raw. That was filmed about 2 years ago in the dump. And I'm in a small town, 300 people. There's a place where you throw your rubbish into a pit and a recyclable bin and a cardboard thing. So that's now all changed now. That's, again, this is a town of 300 people, less than 300. So now we have a gate on it. We have security, we have buildings on it, we have 24-hour lighting that illuminates the whole sky here. You can't see stars now. And anyhow, we have a whole infrastructure now of government employees that are managing the dump. If there's a free store, you have to pay for everything that you take to the dump now. Recycling is not encouraged at all. There's a free store. It's in the film, Tiffany's Free Store. So it's not a free store anymore. If you want to take something to the free store, they put it on a scale and they charge you to take stuff to the free store. No encouragement for recycling here at all. Yeah, very, very bad.
I think that what we will have to do is just end the fossil fuel economy one way or another. And if we don't do it willingly and with a long-term plan, then nature will do it for us with catastrophe after catastrophe that just knocks out the infrastructure. So I'm hoping we do the former and that we get our act together.
Yeah, me too. And, I do see examples of things that work. I wish we would copy more positive models. And rather than going down the road of messes and stuff, there's great hope for mankind if we can get our act together. A CFET radio station here, running on that thing. And there's a community radio station in Whitehorse that I'm involved in. I set it up, it is me, but it's a community radio station. So I'll give you the link to the community radio station in Whitehorse, and you can listen to, you can send that link out there.
I appreciate that. I'll put that in my blog, and thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Rob. It was great to meet you.
Yeah, thanks again for all the information and stuff that you've been providing. Boy, if I feel depressed, I listen to your show, I'm happier way at the end there. When I hear about stories in the Arctic, I think about what do people down south, what is their thoughts about the Arctic? When they hear things, they've watched TV movies and all this stuff and great expanses. And yeah, that's all there. But there's the environmental stuff that's happening here and some of the things that man made. When I came here, Alex, was in 1982, before I was a hobo, hop trains. I came up here in 1982. Now, the day I got here was the day they shut the railway down. And the reason they shut the railway down is the mine in Faro had shut down. That was the largest copper mine going in the world. And it shut down. The entire economy just flattened right out, never really recovered in that scale of a project. But that mine up there, that's our Fort McMurray. There's a big mess out there. It's going to take billions of dollars to get that remediation back to wherever. And the people that ran the mine now, they've all since retired, bonuses paid. You know, we're on the hook for it. And when I say we, it's the people in Ottawa that are paying for the Yukon. We get $2 billion a year transfer payments. Those transfer payments are from Ottawa to keep the Yukon going. If those transfer payments go, then you know, what does the Yukon have left in it? But anyhow, there's lots of ongoing environmental things, and happy to share that stuff with you forever. You know, the latest thing in the news was the PCR COVID tests. You know, they've been the people have been asking for them at Christmas time. Teachers, students, what are we going to do? And we just found out that the Yukon government gave half of their PCR tests to the mining industry. And the mining industry, and this is before Christmas, and then the mining industry comes back and says, we already have our own tests. They didn't even know anything about these things. So it tells you where their priorities are at.
Oh, man. Yeah. So you're running Radio EcoShock from time to time in the Yukon. Is that how it's working?
It plays in Tagish. It plays Sunday at 1 o'clock. And if it doesn't play, then I get people call me and get a hold of me and go, hey, what the hell? Where's Alex? That's the most important thing to listen to of the week. I'm serious, actually. And that runs in Whitehorse, Tagish, and Whitehorse and the city and stuff. Yeah, no, I get that a lot.
Radio EcoShock, providing hard truths to inform citizens and activists. Follow up at ecoshock.org. Yukon broadcaster Rob Hopkins with more on the environment and life in the far north.
The royalties are on mining. It's crazy here. It's crazy how much money we get in royalties from gold. Less than 35 cents an ounce is what the royalty rate is here. On $1,800 US ounce of gold, we get less than 35 cents. What's wrong with that picture? Yeah, right now, the topic is people's power bills have come in, and you know, it was a cold December and January, and all of a sudden people are going, they're doubled. I'm seeing on Facebook people in Whitehorse, they're paying like $1,000 a month for their power bill. Like $1,000, what, you know, I pay $80 a month here, $100 in the winter time and stuff. But how could you spend $1,000? Oh, I know why, because I got sucked into electric heat. The government tried to greenwash everything and said, oh, we want to get everybody off of diesel. And, you know, we want to get everybody onto electricity. And now, you know, now they're saying, well, now we don't have any power, and we got to bring in more generators. And yeah, who knows what's going to happen on that. That's a big issue. But what's underlying on that most people do not know, and I've just learned about this just recently. So I'm part of the Utilities Consumer Group, and I'm the president there. And it's a lobby group looking out for consumers' interests, mostly in telecom and power. And yeah, we've been at rate hearings forever and 30 years of this. And one of the big issues in Tagish now, 20 years now that I've been here involved in this issue, is the Yukon Energy is the sole provider of electricity. They have a dam in Whitehorse, and they want to raise the lake level here 10%. And or some height, and it's gonna generate a little bit. It's gonna like 2 or 3% extra power. It's gonna have more reserves to go through the winter time and stuff. So anyhow, that's the project. And the First Nation have not been on board on this on a number of fronts, and neither have a lot of the people out here. And it's one of these meetings. Everybody goes, and the government says, "Oh, we got support," and they say, "Well, who supports it?" Not one person in the room will say that they support it. But anyhow, the environmental issue to this is it's going to wipe out all the wildlife along the lakeshore. You know, get rid of a whole bunch of swamps. All kinds of stuff is going to disappear. And the reason why they didn't go with this rate increase to include all this year, because we had flooding. This would be the bad time to start talking about raising the lake level when people are their houses are 2 feet underwater and stuff. So that's another issue. When I've been at these hearings, I've asked till I'm blue in the face, man, like my shirt here. And I said, okay, you've got all the computer systems in the world. You've got all the resources. You've got everything. Tell me about your largest customer, right? And everybody looks around at each other. Oh, geez, we don't have that information. We don't know who our largest customer would possibly be, right? Or any of their usage or how they work. And I say, so you're telling me you're not even your accounting person could generate a report telling me who your largest user is and when they're using it? Of course, it's the Yukon government. And my point is that we have acres and acres of heated lit office buildings running 24 hours a day while there's homeless people on the street at minus 40. And why do we have such waste in our government buildings? As one example, the amount of greenhouse gases that generates to heat an empty building for people that don't even have a job that should be in that building. It's madness. It's madness.
From Tagish, Yukon, we have been speaking with Radio Rob Hopkins, longtime independent broadcaster in the North and helping people in many places. Find more about Rob in my blog with links at ecoshock.org.
A special hello to longtime listeners. Contact Alex Smith through the website. Your support and tips are always welcome. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.